This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Danny Cox, and in the early hours of Monday, the 30th of December, these are our main stories. The former US President Jimmy Carter has died at the age of 100. South Korea begins a period of mourning for victims of its worst air disaster. Also in this podcast,
the man who stood beside me and said Ukraine is a sovereign, independent nation state which will make its own decisions is now the man who says that it is not and that it's got to be wiped off the face of the earth.
We look back on 25 years of Vladimir Putin's leadership of Russia. The former American president, Jimmy Carter, has died. He was 100 years old. He was the longest living president in U.S. history. A Democrat, he was the 39th president of the United States and spent 4 years in the White House from 1977 to 1981. He went on to gain an international reputation for his work in promoting human rights. The BBC's Sarah Smith looks back at his life.
As a candidate and as a president, I'll never tell a lie.
That was the essence of Jimmy Carter. People may have questioned his ability, but not his honesty, sincerity, and passion that propelled a peanut farmer to the presidency. He was born in the Deep South, in Plains, Georgia. James Earl Carter cut short a promising naval career to return home after the death of his father. He turned the family business around. Making peanuts made Jimmy Carter rich. Then came the lure of politics. He served 2 terms in the state Senate and 1 as Georgia's governor before bringing his faith-based politics to Washington and a run for the presidency.
My name is Jimmy Carter and I'm running for president.
He campaigned on a pledge to bind America's wounds after Watergate and Vietnam.
I, Jimmy Carter, do solemnly swear.
It was a presidency that would be marked by 1 foreign policy high, marred by other lows. In 1978, he persuaded Israel's Prime Minister Menachem Begin and Egypt's Anwar Sadat to sign the Camp David Peace Accord. It was his finest hour. It's still America's most significant peacemaking in the Middle East. At home, he was an early environmental pioneer, preserving huge tracts of land in Alaska, even installing solar panels at the White House, and an ardent feminist. He encouraged his wife to set up and run her own office in the White House, appointed women to his administration, and declared, "Women's rights are the fight of my life." But an energy crisis saw long lines at the pumps while inflation was rising sharply, and his administration seemed listless, ill-equipped to cope. Worse would follow with the Iranian Revolution and the interminable hostage crisis that followed at the US Embassy in Tehran. 52 Americans were being held. The commander-in-chief seemed out of his depth. A botched rescue attempt left 8 Americans dead. Against that backdrop, there was no way he was going to win re-election. In the event, his loss to Ronald Reagan in 1980 was crushing. But Jimmy Carter was not about to disappear quietly into a gilded corporate post-presidential life. He brought his prodigious energy to human rights issues, setting up the Carter Center in Atlanta, campaigning across the world for democracy and justice. Constantly at his side, his wife Rosalind.
Rosalind and I decided to start the Carter Center with very slight glimmer of hope about it, what it might be, but it has far exceeded our expectations and has given us a very fruitful and exciting and unpredictable and challenging and adventurous, I would say, and gratifying life.
22 years after leaving office, he was awarded the Nobel Peace Prize for his efforts.
Morning, everybody.
Morning.
In Plains, Georgia, he carried on leading Bible study classes. Only when he was past 90 would he tell a news conference, with his trademark humour, dignity and humility, and without a shred of self-pity, that cancer had spread to his brain.
I think I have been as blessed as any human being in the world with having become the President of the United States of America and the work of the Carter Center, and everything's been a blessing for me. So I'm thankful.
That seemed like the final chapter, but it wasn't. Jimmy Carter carried on his work in the United States and around the world, busy trying to make a difference right up to the end. His long-term political ally, President Biden, visited the Carters' modest bungalow, paying tribute to a visionary man of unimpeachable integrity who became America's longest-lived president.
Sarah Smith. And I heard more about the life and the presidency of Jimmy Carter from our correspondent in Washington, Rowan Bridge.
Well, we've seen tributes come in from some of Jimmy Carter's successors, starting with Joe Biden, of course, the current president, saying that America had lost an extraordinary leader, statesman, humanitarian. With his compassion and moral clarity, Joe Biden said he worked to eradicate disease, forge peace, advance civil rights and human rights, promote free and fair elections, house the homeless and always advocate for the least amongst us. And also Bill Clinton has paid tribute, saying, giving thanks for Jimmy Carter's good long life, as he put it, saying how he worked tirelessly for a better and fairer world. And indeed, the Empire State Building is to be lit up in red, white and blue, the colours of the American flag, to honour, as they put it, the life and legacy of Jimmy Carter as well.
A good long life, reaching the age of 100. But his health had been failing, and this didn't really come as too much of a surprise.
No, I mean, he went into hospice care February, so the beginning really of last year. He had cancer. And so we knew that he was in hospice care, and obviously that was sort of end-of-life care. But obviously a significant figure in American history, you know, one of the most significant figures of the 20th century for American politics, given his legacy both at home and abroad. So a major moment for America today.
Politics very divisive around the world. But did he enter politics at, I don't know, maybe a simpler age?
I'm not sure it was a simpler age. I mean, he came into office in the wake of the sort of fallout of Watergate and Gerald Ford pardoning Richard Nixon over alleged criminal activities that had gone on through the White House. It was not a straightforward time when Jimmy Carter came to power. But, you know, if you look at what he achieved on the foreign policy front, for example, you know, the Camp David Accords, the peace agreement between Israel and Egypt, have stood the test of time and perhaps are his biggest foreign policy success that he's achieved, you know, and something that helped to shape the Middle East and has done ever since. So that clearly was a significant triumph. But he also had failures, perhaps the most obvious being the Iranian hostage crisis following the Iranian Revolution in 1979, when Americans were held hostage there. And there was a failed rescue attempt which left 8 American servicemen dead. And that really was really damaging to Jimmy Carter and his re-election effort. And he lost the 1980 election to Ronald Reagan. But in some ways, he's a man ahead of his time. You know, this is somebody who put solar panels on the White House in the 1970s, a move that today would not seem extraordinary. But at the time, you know, was really ahead of its time in terms of his concern about the environment. He expanded the protection of wildlife in Alaska. You know, so he took measures which today would not be seen as out of the ordinary in some ways, but were quite progressive, very progressive for the time.
The 39th president of the US, how will he be remembered?
Like all presidents, their legacy gets sort of picked over and reviewed constantly. And I think he will be remembered, I think, as much for his sort of post-presidency life as for his presidential career. If you look at that tribute that Joe Biden paid, a lot of what he was talking about there, his work about advancing civil and human rights, promoting fair elections, housing the homeless, this was all stuff that Jimmy Carter did post-presidency. He set up the Carter Foundation because he still wanted to be involved in public life after leaving the office. He still felt he had more to do and more to give. And that, in some ways, has become a sort of model for certain for presidents post being in office. You know, if you look at the work, some of the work that's been done by the Clinton Foundation, you know, President Obama has his Obama Foundation. Both of those have clearly been modelled on what Jimmy Carter did. He was the first one to really look at that. How could you work in the public sphere outside of the presidency? And he certainly had a massive impact there, as he says, working with homeless people, helping to eradicate disease, his work around promoting peace. He was involved in the negotiations over the end of the war in Bosnia. He went to North Korea to negotiate with them on behalf of the Clinton administration. You know, he had a significant role in American life.
Rowan Bridge in Washington. South Korea has started 7 days of mourning after the country's worst ever aviation disaster. On Sunday, a Jeju airplane returning from Bangkok carrying 181 people skidded off the runway at Muan Airport and collided with a wall, killing nearly everyone on board. 2 members of the flight crew survived. Our correspondent Jean McKenzie sent this report from the airport.
So forceful was this crash, the body of the plane splintered into small fragments that cover the ground here. The charred tail is the only part of the aircraft still intact. A video of the crash shows the plane land on the runway at speed without its landing gear down. It skids along the tarmac on its belly, overshoots the runway, crashes into the perimeter wall and explodes. The passengers had no chance of surviving, the fire service told the bereaved families who had camped out in the terminal building. Only two flight attendants sat at the back of the plane could be saved. All day, rescue workers and forensic teams gathered the bodies from the wreckage and the surrounding fields until finally, after dark, they'd all been recovered. But it's taking a while to identify them. Every so often, someone in the terminal stands to read out a few more names and their families cry out and crumple in pain. This man, Man Ki Soo, had two great nephews on the plane. The youngest had just taken his university entrance exam, he tells me. Their father had taken them as a treat. It was the first time they'd ever been abroad. I can't believe the entire family has disappeared, he says. My heart aches so much. The flight was operated by Jeju Air, Korea's most popular budget airline, which flies people all across Asia. Earlier, its chief executive expressed his deep regret. I want to sincerely apologise to all those who've lost their lives. It's hard to predict the cause, and we must wait for the results of the investigation, he said. It's thought the pilot couldn't activate the plane's landing gear, and there are reports that a bird entered one of the engines, causing it to catch fire. But proper answers will take time. The black box is severely damaged. The families tonight will sleep at the airport as they wait for more information.
Jean McKenzie at Muan Airport. And as Jean was saying, it's early days in terms of investigating what went wrong with the Jeju airplane. But to get more of an understanding, we spoke to Jeffrey Thomas, who's the editor of Daily Airline News.
It appears as though this aircraft has suffered multiple failures due to a series of bird strikes. We know that the control tower issued an alert to the aircraft just prior to landing of birds in the area, typically mallards. 1 minute later, the air crew declared a mayday. There is vision of one bird strike on one of the engines. Ground observers have said there were three explosions. The crew then declared a mayday. The air traffic controllers then told them to approach the runway from the other direction. So they went to the north and then came down to towards the south. But at 900 feet above the ground, the transponder, which is the device that provides all the air traffic control data to air traffic control about the aircraft, its speed, altitude, etc., ceased. Now, typically, that does not happen. What that indicates is that there's been electrical failures in the aircraft. We can only speculate that possibly there were multiple electrical failures if the transponder failed. And this may have caused a cascading series of problems for the crew, and they weren't able to lower the undercarriage, nor possibly did they have time to manually crank it down, because it could well have been they had multiple engine failures, not just one.
Jeffrey Thomas. A presidential inauguration is often a moment of celebration, but not in Georgia. Protests are continuing to break out as thousands flood the streets of the capital and clash with police over the election of Mikhail Kavalashvili of the Georgia Dream Party. A former football player, he's known for his anti-Western stance and for aligning with Russian values. Meanwhile, the outgoing president, Salome Zurabishvili, has refused to step down. Our correspondent in the region is Rehan Dimitri.
We have seen continuous protests for over 30 days. Despite the inauguration, despite the fact that Salome Zurabishvili is now the ex-president, she earlier said that she won't be stepping down as the president, but on Sunday morning she left the presidential palace and said that her legitimacy is not linked to the building. And those who are protesting now, they consider Salome Zurabishvili still their president.
And what now for Salome Zurabishvili? She says she's going to fight on, but realistically, what is she hoping for? Is there a route back for her?
I think it's a big question. Can we refer to her as the ex-president? Technically, yes, she is the ex-president. However, we see that some of Georgia's Western partners, some of the politicians in the United States who have invited Salome Zurabishvili, by the way, to attend the inauguration of Donald Trump in January, they have stated publicly that she remains the only legitimate president of Georgia. And this whole struggle that we've seen so far, it is all about one demand that people, including Salome Zurabishvili, have been reiterating over and over again. They're demanding new elections. They're saying that this is the only way out of this political deadlock, because with the inauguration of Mikhail Kavelashvili, who's a chosen candidate by the ruling party, critics claim the ruling party has consolidated full power. There is now not a single institution in the country which critics are saying could be seen as being independent from the ruling party.
Georgia has now suspended its application to join the EU. Does the election of the new president mean the country could move further away from Europe and towards Russia?
Well, it is interesting. Today in Georgian media, one particular interview has been quite kind of widely discussed. And this interview is by a former official from the Ministry of Interior. He said that he received threats to himself and his family, so he left the country. And after leaving the country, he gave quite an extensive interview in which he said that in Georgia today, all orders are coming from Moscow. These are his words. And I think it reinforces the belief of the country's opposition that this government is acting in Russia's interests.
Marianne Dimitri. There'll be no quick establishment of any kind of democracy in Syria. Elections, if they come, will be 4 years away. As according to Ahmad al-Sharaa, the new Islamist leader, his group HTS insists it wants to build a nation where everyone feels included. And yet the past week has already seen suspected reprisal killings of Alawites. That's the community which Syria's deposed President Bashar al-Assad belonged to. People who served in his regime's security forces have been promised a general amnesty, and tens of thousands have surrendered. So do they believe that amnesty promise? Yogita Lamaye has been speaking to them.
I'm at a so-called reconciliation centre in the capital, Damascus. This is a centre where people who served in the security forces and intelligence services of the former regime can come to register themselves, to surrender their weapons if they have any, to surrender their vehicles if they were given any. Centres like these have been running in different parts of the country, in Latakia, in Tartus, in Homs, in Aleppo. In front of me, I can see hundreds and hundreds of people who are pressed up against the iron gates of a compound. And one by one, they do seem to be letting people in.
Mohammed Ramadan has come to return the Kalashnikov he'd been assigned. His story gives an insight into why Assad's military collapsed so quickly.
There was no one to give us any orders. Many of our commanders fled before us. So I thought, why should I fight and die for someone who didn't even give enough of a salary so I could feed my family?
My name is Somer Hamoui. I was in the military.
Where were you on the day that the regime fell? Where were
I was on my base, doing my job, okay? Nobody tell us anything that the president is run away. We left us for our destiny. Every people on our base leave his gun, leave his everything. We left us no money, nothing, and run away.
There was a lot of brutality and torture and killings under his regime. How do you feel about having been in the forces of this country when that kind of a regime was in power?
Most of people don't know anything, okay? For me, I don't know what happened on Sadnaya or any prisons, okay?
what we've heard among the crowds here is an intent to move forward. They say they are reassured by HTS's promises that they aren't here to exact revenge. But given the extent of bloodletting and brutality that was seen over 13 years of civil war in this country, is it possible to move forward so quickly and forgive?
There have been a few instances of revenge killings. There isn't a confirmed number at the moment. There's also not much confirmed information about who carried out the revenge attacks. There is a lot of speculation. Some believe they were carried out by Hayat Tehrir al-Sham, HTS, but they're not admitting to it. Some people believe it's other rebel factions. And there are those who believe that it could be pro-Assad militia who want to create tension in the country. About 3.5 hours from Damascus, we've driven through winding roads, through mountainous terrain, in order to speak to the family of one person who was killed in a suspected revenge attack. And we're now heading to the village of Al-Amiriya. This village was the home of Judge Munzar Hassan. He was from the Alawite community. It is a community that Bashar al-Assad and his family belong to. The judge was killed, and it's believed that it was a revenge killing because he was from the Alawite community. I'm going now to speak to his wife, Nadine Abdullah, who's told us that she wants his story to be heard.
Everyone says HTS didn't commit the crime, but as the governing authority now, they must find out who did it. They have to ensure protection for all of us.
Hayat Tehrir al-Sham have denied they've carried out any reprisal and have promised to find the perpetrators. But after the euphoria of the regime's fall, the killings have triggered tensions. It's a delicate moment for Syria.
Yogurt Ilamaye. Still to come on this podcast, the boys from London travelling the world to trace their past.
We're trying to find a home in multiple different places. I've got home in London, in Islington, I've got home in Hargeisa. I even got a bit of home in Bangladesh, I feel like, or in Morocco. It's about children of immigrants coming together and telling their stories.
Despite talks of a ceasefire and hostage release in Gaza, there's been no let-ups in Israeli attacks on the territory. On Sunday, 7 people were killed in a strike on a medical facility in Gaza City. The Palestinian Civil Defense posted that others have been injured at the Al-Wafa hospital. The IDF insist they were targeting Hamas fighters there. Our correspondent Sharma Khalil reports from Jerusalem.
Smoke could be seen on the upper floor of the Wafa hospital in central Gaza with its exterior wall destroyed. Footage showed chaos and a big crowd gathered at the entrance of the hospital as a body was being pulled out on a stretcher and taken into an ambulance, with sirens sounding in the hospital vicinity. The Israeli forces confirmed the strike on the hospital in Gaza City, saying the attack was on Hamas fighters who were using the building as a command and control center, adding that the building was not serving as a hospital at the time. Israel has made similar claims when the army forcibly evacuated the Kamal Adwan Hospital, the last functioning medical facility in northern Gaza. The army then detained and interrogated medical staff and the hospital's director. Israel has so far not provided evidence for these claims.
Sharma Khalil in Jerusalem. Now to Croatia, where the polls have closed in the presidential election. The outspoken incumbent Zoran Milanovic was on top of the opinion polls, despite the election taking place at a time of biting inflation, widespread corruption and labour shortages. Our Balkans correspondent Guy Delaunay says Mr. Milanovic seems to have done a lot better than many expected.
When you look at the polls ahead of the election, they were suggesting 39%. For Zoran Milanovic. What he got was virtually 50%, not quite there. 50% is the crucial mark, because if you take more than 50% of the vote, then you're a first-round winner. There's no need for a runoff. Zoran Milanovic took 49.1% of the vote, so he's not made it to a victory without a second round. But it's a crushing win, because the closest challenger secured 19% of the vote. That was Dragan Primorac, who has the support of the government and the governing HDZ party. But it seems the voters have sent a very strong message about who they think should be the president for the next 5 years.
Because the two men have very different visions for the future of the country.
In some respects, there's been a lot of attention on Mr. Milanovic's views about NATO and the European Union, some people suggesting he's sceptical about both things. I think it's fair to say he's taking a populist stance with regard to the participation of Croatian troops in Ukraine. I don't think that's going to be a very difficult thing for Croatia to have to handle. But I think, more interestingly in a way, it's worth remembering that Mr. Milanovic is originally the leader of a centre-left party, the Social Democrats. He retains their support. He comes out with a lot of populist outbursts. But when it came down to the election campaign, he was still clearly to the left of Mr. Primorac. Mr. Primorac was talking about deporting all irregular migrants. He was talking about making life very difficult for Serbia to join the European Union, making all sorts of demands bilaterally of Serbia for them to go ahead with their negotiations. Mr. Milanovic taking a much more conciliatory stance on both issues. So this centre-left leader that people did see as prime minister at one point is still inside this populist quote machine that we've grown to know over the past 5 years.
Guy Delaunay talking to my colleague Alex Ritson. New Year's Eve often brings a feeling of reflection, but for Russia, it's a pivotal moment in its history. It was 25 years ago that Vladimir Putin was named president, as the clock was counting down to the second millennium. It was a decision that took many by surprise, but perhaps even fewer could have foreseen where the country finds itself now. Our Russia editor is Steve Rosenberg.
New Year's Eve, 1999. A big fanfare. And an even bigger surprise. Russia's president, Boris Yeltsin, announces his resignation and hands power to his prime minister, a man called Vladimir Putin. And so it is Putin who delivers the traditional New Year greeting to the Russian people before the Kremlin bells usher in the new millennium. On leaving the Kremlin, Yeltsin's parting words to Putin were these: take care of Russia. Well, how's that gone? President Putin's full-scale invasion of Ukraine has had devastating consequences, primarily for Ukraine, of course, but for Russia too. Tens of thousands of Russian soldiers have been killed, many more wounded. Russian towns and cities now come under regular drone attack. Ukrainian soldiers have occupied a part of Russia's Kursk region. International sanctions are heaping pressure on Russia's economy, and domestic repression has picked up apace. Over 25 years, I've seen different Putins, and I'm not the only one. Lord Robertson was NATO Secretary General from 1999 to 2003.
So the man who stood beside me and said Ukraine is a sovereign, independent nation state which will make its own decisions about security is now the man who says that it is not a nation state and that it's got to be wiped off the face of the earth.
I've often wondered whether in Putin's own mind he thinks that he has done what Boris Yeltsin asked him to and taken care of Russia. Well, a few days ago, I had a chance to find out. More than 4 hours into his lengthy end-of-year press conference, Vladimir Putin invited me to ask a question. Boris Yeltsin told you to take care of Russia, I said. But what are the significant losses in your so-called special military operation in Ukraine? The Ukrainian troops in Kursk region, the sanctions, the high inflation. Do you think you've taken care of Russia? Yes, President Putin replied. And I haven't just taken care of it. We've pulled back from the edge of the abyss. He accused the West of having patronizingly patted Yeltsin on the shoulder while using Russia for its own purposes. But he, Putin, was doing everything, he said, to ensure that Russia was an independent, sovereign state. I wonder, is this an argument he's come up with after the event to try to justify his war in Ukraine? Or does Vladimir Putin really believe this take on modern Russian history? I'm not sure, not yet, but I sense that it is a key question, and the answer may well influence how this war ends and Russia's future.
Steve Rosenberg. Now, do you remember your first holiday away with your friends? Well, a group of boys from London have been putting an interesting twist on theirs, racking up thousands of views and a growing online audience whilst doing so. The newsroom's Keris Maidment reports.
Whether it's soaking up the sun in Ibiza or dancing in the rain at a music festival, for many young people, your first holiday with your mates is a big deal. But one group of young guys from London have decided to do something different. Zach Hajjaj, Abu Fanin and Kayum Mia have been showing each other around their family's homelands and filming their trips for their YouTube channel. Calling themselves Kids of the Colony, the first stop on their list was Bangladesh, where Kayum's family hails from. According to Zach, it was a great way to start their series.
Going to Bangladesh, Kayum brought me to his village, and being like a visitor there was a great feeling. That's what Kids of the Colony is about. It's like bringing your own friends to your country, showing them not just the world on camera, but showing them like right there in action how it is, how people live. It's a great feeling.
They then continent hopped to Morocco, which offered an alternative experience to their previous holiday.
Morocco was a bit different to Bangladesh, isn't it? It's not really your typical holiday destination.
Morocco is too touristy.
Incredibly touristy.
And then finally, the breakaway Republic of Somaliland, where Abu was keen to show his close-knit ties to the area.
When it came to Somaliland, you know, it meant a little bit more to me. It was my turn, like, I was the host. So I'm going to the neighbourhood that my parents grew up in, and I'm at a coffee shop, and I'm meeting someone that knows my dad, and that we can ask him, yo, can we serve tea? And a lot of that is just through the connections that we have to our ancestral lands.
For their cameraman, Henry, the boys have brought a burst of youth to the travel show industry.
It's a younger perspective on travel and the world. And, you know, these guys, growing up in London, I think it's such a big deal going back to their homeland and stuff. And I just want to be a part of, you know, that cultural experience.
But despite all this globetrotting, for Abu, this project has evoked feelings much closer to home.
When we first done the Bangladesh series, it was crazy because none of us had any experience being on camera or being behind the camera. We're trying to find a home in multiple different places. I've got a home in London, in Islington. I've got a home in Hargeisa. I even got a bit of home in Bangladesh, I feel like, or in Morocco. That's what it's about. It's about children of immigrants coming together and telling their stories.
And this is also what they hope for their viewers, that in watching their videos, they too will be encouraged to reconnect with their roots.
That was the newsroom's Keris Maidment, and you can read the full story on the BBC News website. And that's all from us for now, but there'll be a new edition of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on X at Global News Pod. This edition was mixed by Caroline Driscoll. The producer was Richard Hamilton. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Danny Cox. Until next time, goodbye.